council work session will come to order at 6 o'clock. And let the record reflect that all the councilors are in position and in attendance. We'll do the Pledge of Allegiance now, and I'd like to ask you, Doug, if you would lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance tonight. Thank you.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Are there any added agenda items for this evening? Hearing none, I'll move to item 5, which is ODOT WikiUp Junction Plan and Amy Pfeiffer and her cohorts. And if Amy, if you wouldn't mind introducing.
No problem.
And you've got the floor.
Okay, thank you. I'm Amy Pfeiffer. I'm a project leader on this project with ODOT. And I brought with me Brian Pasley, who is a designer, our engineering designer for the project. So he can answer specific questions if you have any. So I thought I would go through, since we have all new council members since this project started pretty much, and a lot of you probably haven't been involved all along, I thought I would just start with a quick general history of the project and how we got to where we are. So we started this project in 2005, and the purpose that we determined the project was to accomplish was to improve the safety at the BNSF railway crossing in US 97 in WikiUp Junction. So what we did was we did a bunch of public involvement and had a lot of committees set up. So we had citizen advisory committees, which included business owners, residents, and a bunch of, and the city, and ODOT, and BLM, and basically interested parties. Then we had steering team meetings as well, and the steering team consisted of leaders from the city of Lapine, Deschutes County, ODOT, and the BLM. And we had interagency meetings with all the other agencies, Forest Service, all the other kind of players, and some of the environmental agencies. And we had some public meetings. We've had a project information published on our website and a website set up where people can go get information. We've also given several county council updates and a few city council updates on the project. And we also worked with that transportation advisory group that used to be here in Oakland. We also did environmental studies, traffic studies, cost estimates, developed goals and objectives, and developed 15 different alternatives. The alternatives that we developed were multiple variations of these alternatives, that four of them basically bypassed with Lapine, with the bypass extending all the way from Kalina Lakes Highway to Oregon 31. And then we had four alternatives that bypassed just WikiUp Junction portion of it, including different interchange options within WikiUp. We had one alternative that separated US 97 from the railroad just south of WikiUp Junction, and we had one alternative that grade separated US 97 from the railroad at the current crossing location, so right where it is at now. And then we had five alternatives that moved the railroad, basically, in the highway around. So those are the ones we kind of started with, and that was back in 2005. They developed a bunch of goals and objectives because not only we were looking for a solution to our problem on the railroad crossing, but we also wanted to, you know, accomplish some other things with the project. And so these goals and objectives were used to look at, you know, the different alternatives. So what they came up with is these committees came up with safety was important. They wanted to accommodate travel for 20 years into the future. They wanted to eliminate the at-grade rail crossings within the project area, avoid creating any new ones, and ensure there were effective emergency routes in the area. So they also had some around traffic and traffic flow and access. They wanted to maintain mobility and minimize traffic on 97. Avoid bisecting Lapine was important. Provide safe and reasonable access to communities, businesses, recreation, while minimizing the out-of-direction travel for people. Improve access to public lands for recreation and accommodate all classes of vehicles. They also had some social and economic goals. They wanted to minimize direct property impacts to the residents and businesses. attempt to avoid impacts to the public, BLM lands, and the Roslyn Off-Highway Vehicle Area, and support WikiUp Junction's role as part of the City of La Pine's Commercial Center for highway, recreational, and local traffic. They also had some implementation goals. They wanted a long-range solution that could be built in phases. They didn't want the project to preclude opportunities for future traffic improvements on 97, minimize the cost, and maximize the project value. And they also wanted to make sure we were thoughtful about construction impacts, so minimize the delays during construction and address the other impacts to the railroad and the local transportation system in the community during construction. And also achieve compatibility with our Oregon Highway Plan. So kind of what they did was they looked at these, this is kind of the milestones that they went through. So in 2005 was when they developed that huge range of alternatives. Then later in 2005, by the summer, they had already eliminated the alternatives that bypassed all of La Pine. So they figured that that was just heavily impactful to everybody in the community and didn't meet the goals and objectives. And then in February of 2008, they eliminated the alternatives that moved the railroad, because there was a lot of problems associated with trying to move the railroad. And in February of 2009, they actually selected the alternative, which is the overcrossing of the rail alternative, and we began the first phase, the design of that first phase. So the selected alternative is the one that you see on the map, and there's a map of it up here too. So this was the one that the project teams and the public supported and that was developed for the project. There are several things we did after we selected this.
Amy, I was wondering if everybody actually could see that alternative.
Do you want us to describe it?
Everything else.
We can describe it if you'd like. Or we can get to that one after I get through this next phase, because there's a few more.
Another arrow along which piece it is there.
Yeah. Why don't you show them, Brian, which one it is? Or let me take it. Describe how the
patterns
moves and what that alternative really is.
Okay. So what we're doing here is, you see, here's the existing Highway 97. North is at the top. So here's the existing rail crossing. Here's obviously Burgess Road. Here's the railroad coming through here. So what we're doing, we're accomplishing the railroad crossing down here with a single structure. It's a two-span structure. So our new movements will basically be, if you're heading southbound from Burgess, you really won't see any change. It'll actually be an easier movement. You'll come out here to Burgess. You won't even have a stop sign. You'll just take a right turn, it's a right-hand curve, I guess. You'll come down on the old Highway 97 alignment, and you'll come down here to your own lane. It'll just be an ad lane coming into one existing lane. So you have two, kind of into the existing passing lane that is now. So that's the easy move. That's one that's not really changing in what you're driving today. If you are northbound and you want to go on to Burgess, you're going to come up here on the existing Highway 97, and to come here on the new alignment, it'll slowly curve right, and you'll have a right turn D-cell lane, so it's pretty much a free right turn. You'll come, this is elevating, obviously, to get to the bridge, so you'll come up a little ways, you'll take your right turn, you'll drop back down, and you'll go underneath this bridge, and underneath one of the spans of the two-span structure. So you'll be going parallel to the railroad tracks here. You'll come back into the old alignment, take a right turn, come up, then again it's a free left, move back on to the existing bridges. So that movement is not all that different. It's not going to take any more time, really. It's probably a little safer move, but you no longer have that left turn move on the bridges. So you don't have to wait for any gaps necessarily. You just have basically two right turns. You got a right hand turn here, and a right turn hand here. Right hand turn here. So those are the first two movements. The other two movements, if you're southbound 97 and you want to get to Burgess, you'll come down here. As you get past Roslyn, you'll slowly bank left on the new alignment. You won't be crossing the railroad until you get down to here. You go over the top. And as soon as you get over the bridge and you start coming back down, you'll have a right turn lane, right turn D-cell lane, quick right turn, down to the old alignment, bank right, back on the old highway alignment, and then back left like you used to on the old Burgess alignment. That is about a little over a mile out of distance travel from what we had previously. And it was a pretty quick, over the, once you got past the railroad crossings, a pretty quick right-hand turn. So that'll take a little bit more distance. The fourth maneuver there is the from Burgess Road to go northbound. So before, obviously, you took the quick left-hand turn. Once you got a gap, waiting for the left turn there, then get over the tracks. Now you'll come here, you'll continue to take a right-hand turn. You'll come here, and you'll take a left turn here, underneath the bridge, curve around to a right-hand turn here onto your own lane, so you don't have to merge, you don't have to wait for a gap. Just a free single lane you'll add on. Come over the bridge, down the grade, eventually merging into single lane, coming through back on to the old Highway 97 alignment. And again, that's about a little over a mile additional distance from where we're traveling now. Should be safer. And if it'll be quicker, it'll certainly be safer.
Well, you won't be waiting for traffic, so it might actually be quicker.
Yeah. It could be. When you have real bad congestion, it could be quicker. If it's 3 in the morning, it probably won't be quicker.
Definitely safer.
Do you have any questions on how that operates or how
no.
or what's connected?
I mean, when a train's coming through, you're backed up anyway.
You won't have to worry about the train anymore. So you have that.
Yeah. Well, you can wait a long time just for the traffic, especially in the summer.
Yeah. One thing you'll see here, it's not made real clear, but the red line here is basically signifying a barrier on the median. So that will prevent people from trying to sneak a left turn off to some of these ramps. Obviously that's not a good thing. So we want to make sure we prevent that from taking place.
So what's that going to do up at the truck stop?
The only change up here by Gordy's, we're really not here's the end of our changes. Basically we're going to extend that right turn diesel lane so it'll be longer, a little safer. But it really won't be a big change to there. We just still have that tough left-hand turn out. The left-hand turn in is going to be the same. And that's not part of the project. It wasn't one of the goals, besides not impacting them negatively. There was some traffic analysis about cleaning up this intersection. Through the analysis, they said that would provide some benefit to Roslyn intersection, but truthfully, that's pretty minor. We won't see much change there at Roslyn Road.
So you'll still have the trucks backing up, trying to get on 97?
As you're trying to get out, either right or left? Correct. You'll have the benefit that if there's backing up due to the railroad crossing, you won't have trucks stopping because they got hazardous materials where they have to stop their rail crossing. So that'll help a little bit.
But the school bus has to run around, too.
School buses won't be stopping anymore. So traffic will flow easier and faster, so the gap should be a little better. But I'm not going to tell you that it's going to be twice as easy or save you tons of time. It'll be a little better. Whether you see it or not, you'll probably see it in the high congestion times a little bit. But for the most part, I don't expect any real significant change.
The place where the new road comes across next to Gordy's, is that all currently right away, or is Gordy going to have to yield some property?
You can kind of see these yellow lines are really the right away line. So there is this corner, part of this parking lot, in some undeveloped area, or in it's open area, I guess, but there is a chunk from Gordy's, yes. No buildings at all. Yeah, it does take this corner.
Well, I think it's important that you get a longer right turn lane there. You know, you mentioned that
northbound.
Yeah, northbound having a longer shot at the right turn lane because it's pretty quick now.
It is quick. Yeah. I'm pretty sure it's at least double. It maybe kind of triple. Okay. Not so much from a storage capacity issue, but certainly that taper length will be a lot longer.
Right.
So that should be. If we don't know how bad that is really now for. Kind of quick out. So now the belt is slowing down the proper speed, now freaking your bales behind you, pushing right into the.
Well, I think it adds an advantage there that you can actually determine coming out onto 97. If you have people coming, even trucks coming that don't move over, and you don't really, you can't tell their movement to the, you know, if they're going to make a right turn or not until later. Right. When you would have had time to make a right turn and go on north.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
You'll know if people are intending to turn earlier, so maybe you would have that gap to turn left. You won't miss that gap now, which is kind of frustrating.
Well, and you have the same problem coming southbound. The trucks mistake that turn into the mini mart for the turn into Gordy's.
That's right. Yeah.
So we need to discuss at some point closing that entrance and just making one entrance.
Where?
The one into the mini mart.
And make it at Gordy's?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Either that or define the turning lanes.
You're talking up here?
Yeah, where you turn in to go to Les Schwab and.
Yeah.
Well, because now, you know, a lot of the locals know to take Gordy's exit to
go around by Dairy Queen and come
exactly.
Sure.
You know,
it is an issue.
Yeah.
Because now you get the trucks trying to turn into the mini mart, and you have cross traffic while their trailer is stopped right in that intersection, so you have cars. You have a semi blocking an intersection.
Yeah.
True.
And when trucks are trying to go into Les Schwab with flat tires, that is not a very good situation when they're sitting there on flat tires.
I think a lot of that's due to that little frontage road being so close to the highway they can't get lined up.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we looked at that and some of the alternatives and that whole piece through there, and it's just huge. Undertaking, you basically have to buy out all the businesses beyond just north of West Rocks here, all the little house type businesses.
You having said that, I've often thought about when you get down to Drafter, where Drafter comes into 97, there's the wood carving, right. that whole building thing and the wood carving and all that. I've seen Class A motorhomes pulling cars, pull up there to park on the edge of the road, and they've gotten over as far as they could, and they've just barely got door space to get their door open and get out mm-hmm. of the driver's side, and I've often wondered if that's is somebody encroaching on the right of way.
Oh, that right away is so narrow in there. I mean, we're up against the railroad on one side, and we're up against the private property on the other. And there's really, it's just, the highway itself is as wide as it can get mm-hmm. without taking more property from the private side. So there's really not a good solution in there until we redevelop that whole area. We've worked with the folks in there, tried different things. You know, there may be little things that we can do, but. There's not a lot we can do at the moment just because of the physical configuration.
Yeah.
And if we do much, you know, we end up taking somebody's property and maybe cutting off their access. It just gets really complicated in a hurry because of the lack of room. And heaven knows, as long as we're not hurting people, we don't want to go to business. That's not something we're going to be pushing for.
Well, one step at a time.
This will be a big improvement here.
Mm-hmm. Any more questions on that? Actually, how this operates or anything that we're going to move on?
That's good.
So we've done some work on the project since 2009 when we selected this. We completed the environmental work. We did survey work. We coordinated with the railroad to make sure they were happy with our alternative. We worked on design and did a bunch of technical studies. We did a value engineering study, which basically looks at, you know, how can you provide the most value out of the project and look at various alternatives during that process as well. We coordinated with different agencies. We gained support from City of Lapine for seeking funding for the project. And there's a resolution number 2009-047 that's signed from the City of Lapine saying we support it. Let's move forward and try to get construction funding. But as of today, we do not have construction funding identified for the project. So the next steps that we're looking at completing is we'll have the design footprint pretty much complete in December of this year. And then we'll set up a steering team meeting in January to determine the next steps. And we will need a member from City of Lapine to serve on that steering team. We need to include this project in your local planning documents, your comprehensive plan, and your TSP. And that's one of the issues we ran into with the project, is that it falls smack dab in the middle of your open space, basically, designation. And so you'll want to look at how those two mesh together. We also are going to seek construction funding, and we probably will end up developing some IGAs, doing some land transfers, you know, figuring out who's going to have what road jurisdiction and all that kind of stuff. And we're also planning on rolling this out at a public meeting, a bigger public meeting, after we get the footprint. So that's coming up here probably in January or February. So that's pretty much all I had. Does anybody have any questions?
Well, you know, we were here the other day and uh-huh. talked on this, can we assume that at we get to this point, this will be shovel ready?
It'll be put on the shelf. The environmental work will be done, so it will easily be able to be picked up and the right of way purchased and go to construction.
Yeah. Is there any method that a project like this, is there a listing or something that says it's shovel ready? I thought I read somewhere where there was some kind of registry at ODOT that listed items that were shovel ready. I mean, they'd gotten completely
well, right.
through everything. And
that's what. Well, it's on the STIP as a development project right now. So as soon as it's completed, we pretty much know it's shelf ready.
Okay.
And there is a big list of development projects that are in that same phase. So
is this also? I heard that this railroad crossing was the only grade level crossing in the state
major
on a major highway. They sure check that off their list if they did this soon.
Yeah, nice. And, you know, the funny thing, speaking out of turn, but these kind of projects, they look big and they're real expensive. And if you just put them in line with all the others, you know, it looks like it'll be forever before they get there. But the funny thing happens with big projects. You know, they might sit there for a while, all of a sudden money pops up. Boom, somebody's got an extra $20 million. And you got the job ready to go. Take, for instance, Lava Butte. That second set of lanes on there was planned, it was desired, but we didn't think there was going to be money for it. All of a sudden, this Obama-era money pops up. There's another, hey, here's another $50 million. Go build that lane. Now, Bachelor, we got word last week that we got funding to pave that whole road at $9 million. Just out of the blue. I mean, it wasn't out of the blue. I mean, but you don't always see it coming. You don't always know who cancels the project across the state, and the money just shows
up.
It's not really predictable.
Is that the Cascade Lakes pipeline? That's going to be repaved.
Yeah.
I'm going to use the Red Rock.
No. Red Rock breaks down too quickly. It's,
okay.
It's really pretty, but it's, it breaks down too quickly, and under today's traffic, it's cinders. It's the same stuff we sand the road with. So, you know, it crunches up pretty quickly.
So what phase of the design are you at?
We're at the kind of footprint level. So it's designed in enough detail to know what property we would need to acquire.
So are we here at 30 or not yet?
So in December we should be in the 30% occupation range.
So, now in January, that quality-based selection that QBS will come into play. So, can the city have a say in one of the criteria? Let's say maybe a local contractors or
Oh, you mean as far as how it's contracted?
Yeah. For this, yeah, because it'll be probably fall within that QBS, the quality-based selection.
I'm not much into the contract side of things, but project this size pretty much follows all the rules. And does that allow for local contractors? Well, if I'm local, I can think of it as Oregon.
Well, this law will allow you, because it's a construction project, and it'll allow you to set some criteria to the selection. It's not necessarily going to have to go by price, which we all were traditionally tied to,
right,
but by qualifications. And if the city of La Pine was able to put some sort of criteria in there, because being that it is within our local jurisdiction, like for instance, to give preference to local contractors, I'm not sure if we have a local contractor here that would be, have the wherewithal to do a project this size, or maybe stipulate something about the subcontractors. That, you know, if you can make a note of that, when that whole process pans out.
It really depends will depend kind of on the color of the money. That QBS program, as I understand it, is going to be available for projects that are funded with state funds. But this, most of our projects of this magnitude, we have federal funds attached.
Oh, that's right.
And the federal funding, we really do follow all the rules. And the reason that FHWA does that for these larger projects is just to avoid the corruption kind of that they've seen in the past, where, mm-hmm, you know, it's really hard to control the bidding process. And so they do that for a reason. They put those rules in for a reason, to not allow us to just select who we want or who we go fishing with or any of those kinds of things. And so it probably will have federal funds. It's a large enough project that it probably won't be completely state funded.
Right.
And so it probably will go through a competitive bidding process.
Yeah.
However, there's ways that can make your local contractors more available for subcontracts and that kind of thing. We have a small contracting program that works on smaller bits and pieces of construction projects, like building the fence, for instance, on the Lava View project that we just did.
Yeah.
A local contractor is doing that, not the big prime contractor. And so I can have, like, our small business contracting person come down and talk to you guys and give you information so that you can provide it to the community, mm-hmm, for them to be able to sign up for that program and be ready for when anything like this does come up.
Yeah. Yeah, Amy, let us have you do that, please.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Did you say, throw out a number of what you estimate the cost of this project to be?
We think it's going to be about $24 million.
I want to allow the public to ask questions. I mean, if everybody's short and done. Are there any questions? Karen?
You say there's no left turn coming out of Burgess, only a right turn. What happens to that business that sits on the corner of Burgess on, if you're coming that direction, it would be on the north side of Burgess?
You're talking here, I assume, this location?
There's a gas station and a little mini-mart, you might call it, but little grocery store.
You still have the access.
It takes all the access Burgess away from that business by bringing them clear down, and then they have to go back up. And I don't know of too many people that are going to want to go down 2 miles and then go back 2 miles. That business is really going to be in trouble.
I think if I could...
So I live in that neighborhood. That was one of my thoughts.
Yeah, no, we're definitely... The crossing at grade rail crossing is going away, so that makes it definitely require, for those that are coming from the north, you may come from the south, it's not really a change.
Well, excuse me, but I think what she's implying is that people who are coming north now, they can see that gas station, and they can make a decision to make their turn right up to the point of the turn before they just before they cross the railroad tracks. So the way this is going to be laid out, in effect, for the people going north, they won't have access to that gas station because one, unless they know about it, you know. So all of the tourists and all the people going through there will lose that because they won't identify it before they get out of turn gate.
Yeah, there's some mitigation for that. I mean, there's signing, there's some TIC sign that can specifically call out some of those businesses. But it's not the same, certainly, as being able to make a last second turn once you see it. But we can at least accomplish some of that, usually through signing.
Okay.
Well, a lot of the folks that use that are tourists are already going to Burgess to go out to the lake.
True.
If you're going to the lakes, they're mm-hmm. still good. Yeah, if you're still bypassing and just heading north, they're still that risk.
But that's good.
There'll be signage for the lakes, I hope.
Definitely.
Okay,
yes,
good.
That signing will definitely
Won't they have business signs like they do on other parts of the freeway or the highways that say next turn there's gas or next turn there's groceries or something like that?
True. That's a different program. It's the blue signs typically that you're speaking of. That's usually handled through the tourist information.
Yeah, they have them for hotels, they have them for restaurants, yeah. Everything on the major highway.
Yeah. Businesses can make basically an application to the TIC, that council, and then kind of set that up.
But the whole point is that we, as a council, could kind of apply a little pressure to see that those signs are put up for those particular businesses, couldn't we?
They could apply for it. Just
always that opportunity to apply for
pressure.
It isn't ODOT necessarily that puts those signs up.
I understand. My thinking was that if we could get a hold of the people that we're supposed to, we could apply some pressure to them to see those signs put there.
It's usually not a really hard, a difficult thing to accomplish. We're not talking, if there were 100 businesses here, there's some limitations, and we don't want more than about 4 per sign.
Yeah.
We don't want to get sign clutter, which isn't a big concern at this point. So I think the chances of being successful and getting those signs for the couple of businesses that are there would be in pretty good shape, I think. Again, it's not my decision or even necessarily ODOT's, but we can give you the proper names to call.
Okay.
Are there people coming from Burgess turning right and then having to go north? Is there going to be a stoplight, or is it just going to be a turn lane? And then, in the morning traffic, will there be backup? I mean,
Do you need him to draw it down and show that pattern again?
Where is it that they're going to be turning to go north?
Okay. So if you're coming out of Burgess and you want to head north, where you normally take the left, now you'll just have a left-hand curve. The road will just curve. So it's not an intersection anymore. So it's just a curve right. You'll curve left. You come down here. There'll be a left-hand turn lane to take a left right here. But there won't be a lot of traffic because now you're not dealing with 97 traffic. So the only people you're having to avoid are those that are trying to get to Burgess from this way. So just like you had the right turners, those are the right turners that you're trying to avoid now. So the numbers of those, especially in the morning, are probably going to be a lot less. Most people are probably coming out of Burgess in the morning. So it works out pretty well that way. So this should be a pretty easy move. But come underneath here, and then this one's really easy. It's a free right turn. You need to slow down, maybe stop control, but we're coming into your own lane, so you don't have to wait for a gap at all. So that would be a pretty easy move. Certainly easier than trying to get a left out of the Burgess.
Any other questions from the public? Okay. Council?
Has there been any analysis to kind of figure out how many people will avoid this after you put it in and maybe want out Huntington and take State Rec Road and come across? As I, seeing it from my perspective, if I happen to live where Doug lives, for instance, I would never come this way if I were going to Bend. I'd go up toward State Rec Road and come across up there.
Right. I know they did the modeling. This wasn't myself, but our traffic planning and analysis unit did. They modeled this intersection, so they have all the volumes. I don't remember offhand how many trips they thought were going to go north to State Rec Road. I don't think we had the signal in at the time when they did the modeling. So there's a few variables maybe. We could probably track that down at least to see if they do have an answer for that. I haven't heard that number come out yet.
I believe that once they pave that section of Huntington that's dirt, and that is in the comp plan for the county, you'll see a lot more traffic going that way. Just, it's safer.
Even if I live where you live, I think I'd probably still go that way.
I probably would.
I'm sure people will drive both routes and see which is quicker, but I would certainly imagine a few people. Definitely going to be some trips that are going to... This is a pretty easy move. No one likes to do out-of-direction traffic. You hate to drive by where you're trying to go. You hate to drive south to go north. Mm-hmm. Just...
Well, unless you have a teenager you're teaching to drive, you might want to have them go the safer way.
Yeah.
And, I lived in Deschutes or Wood before we had an intersection or an interchange. It was kind of hairy. And if you get your teenagers out of there...
And if you think about safety-wise... There's more accidents at State Rec Road intersection than 97 at Burgess, especially in the summertime.
You're right, but we're still creatures of habit.
I'm serious, we are.
I know.
And if we think that we can save 1 minute by going the other way, there's no people who will do it.
That's their choice, you know. Safety-wise, this is a lot better than going up to State Rec Road.
I agree.
One more question, and since I didn't mention it before, name and address, but Karen Ward has a question. She lives on Pine Lane, I think. Karen?
I see what it does for me and what it does for the people that are segregated in that little area there. We will be taking State Rec Road or the other road and coming in when we come south rather than to make your little loop-de-loop to go back the 4 miles or however many miles it is. Now, going into the city, I avoid 97 anyways and always go inner roads, okay? So that won't bother me to do that. Going to the left... to the north, I won't take that way.
You'll go out the back roads?
I will go back down and go around Huntington and go back up to one of the other roads that go to the right and go out to 97. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Council, any further questions?
Thank you.
Amy?
I don't have anything else.
Okay. We'd like to thank you very much for coming all the way down here on such a cold night. You know, but you did make it down before daylight saving time.
That's right.
I'm sorry, Dan.
Well, I had made a note here and I forgot to ask it. Somebody mentioned that the bypass of Lapine had been an alternative and that had been rejected. Often I hear people just saying, well, when the bypass happens and the bypass is in the plans and that kind of thing. And I think I saw it on paper somewhere, but is that, does ODOT see that as some kind of a long range, something that is going to happen someday, or?
Well, it's not currently on the radar screen. And bypasses are getting harder and harder and harder to fund, basically. So there is a future phase envisioned here that doesn't bypass Wickiup or the highway, where we actually build more connections through Wickiup of the local road system and then connect it up more like an interchange, and then have cut off highway access and have baggage roads, those kinds of things. But as far as I know, the bypass is not really in any planning documents that I know of. I know that you guys are in the process of updating your TSP coming up here, and also Deschutes County is in the process of their TSP updates. Mm-hmm. So we haven't seen anything in the plans that show that's necessary just yet. In 20 years, you can revisit it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming, mm-hmm. and it's been an excellent presentation.
Thanks.
Okay.
Maybe next week, but not tonight.
You can move on to Pat while I clean up.
Excuse me?
I said you could move on to Pat while I'm cleaning up if you want to.
Oh, we actually have another presentation. So, anybody need a break?
No.
Okay. What we can do, of course, is item 6 was the ODOT facility. Is that you, Pat?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Please.
I'll just give you a brief.
Okay.
The Lapine Station, we know, has been, we've known for decades, it's no longer in the correct spot. It's right there in commercial zoning. I talked with Rick Allen about it the other day. We had the identical situation in Madras when he was up there. And long story short, the legislature only funds one maintenance station every 2 years if it needs rebuild or major work. So Lapine is a long ways down the list. We've had it on the wish list since I've been here, that's 20 years. But, it's slowly going nowhere. but we know it's going to need something someday, and one day the economy is going to come back, and that's going to be very valuable property for commercial use. But it belongs to BLM.
Right.
We're there with a long-term permit. And there's a couple of options, and only one sounds good to me. I mean, one option is that legislature gives us a whole bunch of money and we go off to the industrial park or some other place around here that we can all agree is a good spot for ODOT to be with their sand pile and trucks and whatnot. And that's a lot of money. You're talking, this year we're building a sister's maintenance station, that's about $3 million. And we already own the land. So in the future you're gonna be talking $5-6 million. That's not just the money you get. But one alternative that I really like and I'm working towards is that on the coast and around Lincoln City, two different areas, developers have come in and said, we really want to build a mall here. You're in a good spot. We'll find you a piece of land and build you your buildings, and then we'll trade. And ODOT has done that twice that I know of. Okay, and so that's what I'm working towards here. If we can acquire the BLM land that we sit on, when that developer shows up or some other opportunity comes along, we can move. I mean, we can do something. Right now, we would have to find money to buy land, and then we have to find money to rebuild all the buildings we already own. Nothing wrong with the buildings we own. They're a little bit outdated, but we can live with that. I know that the city is working with BLM on acquiring some properties for the sewer and neighborhoods and various things, and have already been successful in, I think, whatever.
At the Senate level, yes.
Okay, so I don't know if we missed the boat on that one, but if we can work that same deal, ODOT has other properties we can trade. We've got riverfront property up on the John Day River. We've got pieces out in the hinterlands that BLM would like to have because it's surrounded by BLM. And we brought it up a couple of times before, but there wasn't a lot of enthusiasm. There might be now. And with the city's backing, as we talk to BLM over time, trying to get them to come to the table, we may be calling on you, and I did talk to Rick, and he said he was in favor of it. He would support us if we got to talking to BLM about acquiring that property. It's 10 acres. We sit on about 8 of it. The highway takes up about an acre of, in that little corner of small trees over...
That little park?
By the Piano Park now. That's BLM's also. That's part of that 10 acres. So anyway, that's the long-term plan and the short-term plan, and the only plan that we have right now is to acquire the rights to that property, and then we're in a position where we can move, you know, wheel and deal in the future about getting some kind of movement to get out of the middle of town.
What time frame would you see that? 5 years? 10 years? Just a guess, Pat.
10, 15. You know, it goes by pretty quick. In my mind, it does anyway.
Yeah.
But getting the land is key. Otherwise, it's going to be very difficult to move.
I've heard several people say that we ought to go back to Congress and ask them to, you know, convey that property to the city.
Well, I'd definitely write the letters and do the campaign if we could get some indication from our representatives or senators that that's something we'd be able to carry forth. Now, I don't know, do you have a hotline to the senator?
Well, I heard that from one of his people.
Okay.
And that's really, and this was 3 or 4 months ago. And that's the only reason I bring it up.
Would that include the fire station property? I heard that was part of the BLM too, right behind us, right behind there.
I didn't know that that was, but...
I'm not sure that it is. I was just told that it was. It's not. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, the administration, that was part of BLM, but then they deeded that over to the fire district.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I thought if I get in touch with Rick, and he can give me the name of that person in the senator's office, and I can start writing Larry.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Try and get that moving. And come back and ask for formal support, you know, later on when we get some indication of what they're willing to do.
Just can we recap? Because I'm a little confused. First, we're giving it to the city, then we're giving it to the state. So, what is it? In bullet points, what are we trying to accomplish here?
The land that the ODOT maintenance station sits on is BLM, so mm-hmm. ODOT would try to acquire that land. From the BLM?
To be deeded to ODOT.
ODOT, right. Okay. And then once we own the land, then we can talk to developers and whoever comes along and wants that piece of land is willing to purchase it.
Okay, so then you would need the city support to lobby for the BLM land.
Correct. To... Okay. Right. Yeah, we wouldn't, I'm sure we wouldn't go any get anywhere without city support, so...
Right.
Yes, but then we would do the work. We just probably ask for a letter.
I think that the crux of the whole BLM land transfer was that it was supposed to be the purpose was supposed to be for public use. Mm-hmm. So would that be how it is selling it to a developer?
Well, there's no developer really knocking on the door, but if we...
But that's the plan, right?
Yeah, that'd be the plan. I don't know how else we could do that financially.
And then you were talking about something else, right?
Well, yeah, I was talking about just having mentioned to me by somebody in Wyden's office, Senator Wyden's office, that maybe the next thing we need to be moving on is getting that 10 acres conveyed to the city.
Oh, to the city.
Yeah, but you know, yeah, the other side of that too could be is that if you've got properties that you would trade, you know, I can see BLM jumping on a waterfront property out on the John Day.
Yeah, they're using it right now under permit, but that permit's just expired. We can use that as a bargaining chip. Now, does the city own the industrial park?
No, the county does.
County does.
For now.
Well, we can talk.
For now.
Okay.
For now.
Well, we can talk. I mean, if the city got that piece of property and we, you know, we could move us out to the other point and sell it off however they want to, that's fine with me.
How close do you need to be to 97?
Oh, I wouldn't want to be more than about a mile, or we could probably do a mile, mile and a half, 2 miles. We don't want to be too far because that's a lot of wasted fuel and response time. You know, it's good to be right on it, but
so this station maintains from Lava Butte to
It's Vanderbilt Road to 98 or 58.
58.
Right in and out on 31 for 17 miles.
And then Chemult Station comes up to 58?
They come up to 58 and up 58, 16 miles, and down south, 23 miles south of Chemult.
And then Ben's maintenance comes?
Right to Vanderbilt Road. Now they cross, they will cross to the interchanges. Because our sand pile's at Vanderbilt. So they'll pull in there, both sections will pull in there, but a lot of times, in order to get the whole interchange, the Pine will go up and hit their side of it, and Ben will come down and hit their side of it. Just before ramps, it's not easy to get it all, so two crews hitting it makes a pretty good deal.
And then when it's really bad, I think you guys have gone clear up to 58, or you go wherever you're needed.
Well, we'll move people from one station to another, we'll leapfrog them, you say, if it's not hit so bad in Prineville. Several times we brought Prineville people down here to help out, and Pine and Chemult. Sometimes Ben moves down. It's a fluid
right
situation.
But you'd prefer a mile from 97.
Yeah, I would. You know, we consider other things, but I try to stay within that. Closer the better.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much, Pat.
Thank you.
All right.
Justin is next on the agenda, and we'll just move right into Park and Rec's presentation. Thank you for coming.
Today was I just wanted to kind of give an update. I was asked to give an update, kind of a year or plus in review, and then go over the park rules. So I had a presentation, and if it comes back on, we'll go ahead and go through the presentation. I had some pictures and stuff, and I can flip this around and we can review that. But I just wanted to give an update on kind of where the park district is at, answer any questions, and then talk about the park rules. So, and I brought extra copies of the park rules for the audience or for anybody else that needs a copy. Do all the counselors have a copy?
Yeah. Okay.
If you want to handle that. First, the year in review. So, some of the accomplishments since May 2009, and it did really kind of May 2009, because I don't think the park district has been to the city since that point, and there's a lot that's happened. And if you remember, in May 2009, the voters passed the voter-approved tax rate of 30 cents per thousand of assessed value for the park district. Hired the first executive director. Since then, we've had several special events, two egg hunts, one trick or treat. We have another trick or treat coming up this Monday, 5 to 7 o'clock at the Lapine Event Center in that park area there. We did our first movie in the park, and this projector here is going to do more movies in the park next summer, so we'll have a series of four movies the last 2 weeks of August, and the next 2 weekends of September. That way we have a lot going on in the community, and we need it to be a little bit darker in order to get the adequate light, so it's all kind of going to benefit everybody. We have enhanced marketing. You know, we have our newsletter that I think you all have seen, Facebook. We do a lot more ads in the Newbury Eagle, Wise Buy, Sprint's Your Advertiser, just trying to get the word out. Continuation of our great youth sports programs. We've seen an increase in our programs, an increase in our participation. We're going to be rolling out middle school soccer. We did girls volleyball this fall. You know, we're talking with the middle school about assuming some of the programs that are now currently being run in Bend, assuming them back to Lapine, to have, you know, kind of that localized control, if you will. And then we have our community school program for youth in Lapine, which serves our middle school and high school students. And that program kicked off 6 weeks last April, and now we've just finished our first 4 weeks of this year. So still pretty new, and a lot going on with that program, and a lot more to happen. I had some nice pictures, soccer, the city at Trunk or Treat last year. So I know you guys are going to be back again. So, some of the accomplishments continued. You know, we've done some policies, we've done contracting, our meeting records, you know, a lot of just kind of those foundational pieces. One thing, you know, when we first started this whole path was talking about building a solid foundation. It was a foundation for the future, not just you can't have the family room, you can't have the kitchen until you actually build a solid foundation for your district. And so it took some time to do a lot of the policies, a lot of procedures. You know, we established a Park and Recreation Foundation, which has been successful in raising over $50,000 towards the Lapine Event Center. You know, we have the Finley Butte improvements, which include an entryway, a playground, some new grass area and irrigation that I'll show you here. Also, we cleaned up the landscaping. You know, the Lions Club, they came out and they tore out all the bitter brush. You know, they cleaned up a lot of that park, so you have better sight lines for the county sheriff when they come by to patrol. So we're trying to beautify the park, and there's a lot more to do out there. You know, it's not done by any means. We have a master plan that's on our website, on our comprehensive plan, and that shows a lot of our vision for that park. So, but there's still a lot to do, and here's some pictures of that park here. So just kind of do that. And so this is the new ball field here. And as you can see, the grass is growing in. We skinned the infield. It's looking great out there. And that's it. That was like 2 days ago. So the park's really moving along. And last couple years ago, they tried to do some irrigation. The pump just wasn't right. So, you know, one benefit with the tax rate is that we're able to actually put the adequate size pump in there. So we went from a 25 horsepower pump to a 5 horsepower pump that gives us 70 gallons a minute versus one that gave us 25 gallons per minute. So we're able to do just a lot more. We don't have to water it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You know, we can do better watering out there, and it's just better for our kids. And then we added the first 0-5 playground in Lapine. Lapine didn't have a preschool playground except for the one down at the daycare, but that's for private use. So this is the first public 0-5 play space for kids in Lapine. So instead of the 2-year-old being up on the 6-foot-high slide there, now the 2-year-old has an adequate space to play. And we were able to accomplish this with a $4,000 grant from the Rotary of Sun River, was able to help us with that, and they actually did a lot of the labor to install that. Then the new entryway here at the Finley Butte building, we were able to do that working with the Gay West and their remodeling business. We were able to spruce that up, you know, add some pine elements there that are more representative of Lapine. Just some features that say, hey, you know, you're in Lapine, you're in kind of a rustic area. And ultimately, there's a lot more to do at that building as well, just like the Lapine Event Center. You know, it doesn't have any natural light in it except for that front door. The bathrooms are ADA compliant. The kitchen needs some help as well. You know, one problem we have in that building is that the pipes are so corroded that the amount of water that gets to the one toilet just doesn't seem like the toilet's working. So we had a group in there, and they were here for 8 days. They had about 75 people in there, and they were a Jewish group. They were having this big celebration, and they kept calling me, hey, the toilet's not filling right, the toilet's not filling right. But we could have more of those groups, and we could better serve them if we had adequate plumbing in that building. So that's one of our long-term plans is to kind of redo the plumbing, redo the bathrooms, and redo that kitchen area to provide the adequate plumbing. One thing to mention about that group is they were here for 8 days. They spent over $5,000 in our restaurants. They paid $1,600 in rental fees to the Park District. So there was a huge economic benefit to our local community. You know, one family alone spent $1,100 on lodging. in Lapine. So that's a huge benefit that this building brings to our community. Another group that we had in there was a group from Medford, a group of healthcare providers. They have people from all over the state, and they chose Lapine for their corporate meeting. They had 50 or 60 people come to this building here for a week, and they used it because it was a central location for Medford and all of their Central Oregon healthcare providers. So this is a great building, you know, and I think it's something that the Park District wants to do more of. You know, with this building and the Lapine Event Center, I think we have two great buildings that can offer a great array of activities and convention opportunities for Central Oregon and for our community. So that's definitely something you want to leverage in the future. Roslyn Campground, you know, we've had a camp host the last two seasons. This has helped to increase just our stability out there. We've secured over $142,000 from the state of Oregon for a state park grant. We've installed a new pit toilet out there, and that $142,000 is matched actually with about $90,000 from our local community, and $70,000 of that is in-kind donations. So that's, you know, Rick Wirth donating some electrical, you know, help. That's Scooter donating some time out there to build a piece of play equipment. You know, that's a whole bunch of different people coming together to really make that park happen. You know, if the city's donating some money to that from the transit room tax to get that off the ground. So it's everybody coming together to make that project happen, and I think they'll be a real jewel for our community. And one of the big things of that is we're building a 30 by 60 picnic shelter, and the hope is to start construction of that this coming spring, have it done and have it ready for our annual picnic sometime in August or maybe early September. So in the JCJ building, we've done some insulation, new cabinets, and the landscaping look a lot better. You know, every time people come to that building, like, oh, look, the landscaping looks so much nicer now that you have some resources to be able to, you know, keep it up consistently. You know, we water it, fertilize it, have a weekly maintenance out there. So it's really making that place look sharp. So here's the pit toilet, and here's the new cabinets. Patrick's Woodworking did those cabinets. He does a great job, and just really nice quality. So, and plus it just adds to that table there, that Russell table. So, and we were able to get a lot. There's a lot of stuff that AA uses that building a lot that was just kind of hanging out in that room. So we were able to put it behind closed doors, lock it up, keep it safe, but also keep the clutter down in that room to make it just that much better. So. Then the Lapine Event Center. This is one of our key projects that we're working on right now. We're going to be doing some heating, ADA improvements, a glass door, a natural light, roll-up door. We're insulating the ceiling. We're working on the bathrooms, some storage, minor improvements to the kitchen area. We're adding a triple sink in the kitchen. Joel Brader with Harvest Depot is donating a triple sink for that project. So we'll have a nice stainless steel triple sink. We're expanding some of the countertops in there for the interim, for kind of that interim kitchen area, with later hopes of doing the catering kitchen and eventually a commercial kitchen is what our ultimate goal is. Improved appearance of the landscape. You know, again, people comment on it's nice to see green grass out there. You know, you're watering it, you're mowing it, you know, you're keeping it up. Like, hear that, you know, every summer once the grass comes back. So. And here's some pictures of the demo. This picture here was taken a couple days ago, so you can see that they're already drywalling the area. This is the storage area. There's a family bathroom here, so for older adults and people with kids, you know, there'll be a changing station. There'll be, you know, a place to help other people in privacy, you know, so you don't have to be in the men's or the women's bathroom doing that with your elderly adult parent or whoever, you know, you may be working with. In this area up here, this is where all the HVAC equipment or heating, ventilation, cooling is going. So we'll have all the heat. The heat pumps are going to be outside, but the distribution units are all up there, so they're out of the cold, they'll last longer, and we put in this big hole here, so you could, you know, eventually put, you know, use a lift to get things in and out of there, so you don't have to go up the ship's ladder that we have, or the stair, or the, kind of the multi-purpose stairs, which are, they're going to be steep, not steep like ladder, but they'll be like a library ladder or something, a little bit, with a little bit better tilt, bigger tread, but it definitely won't be something you want to carry a heating unit up. So, and eventually there'll be a lid on the first floor area, but we'll maintain some type of hatch in order to get the utility vehicle up there to deliver what it needs to deliver. So, it's just kind of a maintenance thing. So then kind of our core areas of focus over the next couple years is the Lapine Event Center, getting that completed, continuing the fundraising. Roslyn Campground and Day Use Area, you know, we'll start phase one the hope is to have phase one done by September 2013. That's when that grant expires, so that's kind of why we picked that date. And plus, as everybody knows in this room, the construction season is pretty short in Lapine, so I think we got lucky this year with October, but typically it's not so, you're not so lucky. The Lapine Community Park, you know, helping out Finley View Park, continuing to develop those sports fields out there for our youth, and adult softball and football and, you know, soccer, all the different programs that are going on. Youth programming's definitely a core area of focus. Existing special events, keeping those up. Policies and procedures, continuing to refine our policies and procedures and move that body of work forward. And then a better partnership with the Senior Center. One thing that we're doing is December 18th, we're going to be holding a joint fundraiser with the Senior Center. From 2 to 4, it's kind of a tea from around the world. We're going to have 6 different types of tea, different desserts. You know, the seniors are going to be talking about different things that is going on in their center. The youth are going to be talking about different things that are going on with our youth program. And we're going to have a silent auction there. Just one step, you know, in that process of building a stronger relationship with the Senior Center. Another thing we did is we worked with the football team and had purchased some bark chips and threw down some fabric to help kind of beautify an area out there. And I think better coordination, communication, you'll see better, more events like that in the future. So. Any questions on any of that item? I know I kind of ran through that, but I want to respect your time and get to the park rules. So.
Exciting.
Yeah. And I think one thing, too, that I didn't mention in this presentation is since, you know, May of 2009, we've raised an additional $729,000 in grants and in-kind. For this community. So, you know, we've taken essentially the $200,000 that's invested every year in Lapine, and we've doubled that, you know, and almost tripled that to some degree. So, you know, we want to be wise with the investment that the community is making in the park district. And one way we do that is by applying for grants. Mm-hmm. You know, so we've secured, you know, $200,000 from the Ford Family Foundation, $50,000 from the Collins, $150,000 from the Meyer Memorial Trust, at $142,000 from the state of Oregon, that's through the lottery fund. $20,000 from the Oregon Community Foundation, another $20,000 from Mabel Clark McDonald, another $50,000 from Deschutes County Children and Family Commission. They've given to programming for the youth in our community because they see a value investing in our youth. Because they know that they're going to see them downstream in the jails if they don't do something for them now by keeping them out of trouble and giving them, you know, the skills to be positive civic members and move forward. So there's a lot going on.
Do you want to mention anything about the Ford improvement of the park area there on the Huntington Inn?
So another thing that we're working on too is working with the Ford Family Cohort 2, and they're developing you may have seen the swing set out there at the Frontier Heritage Park and the archway, and that's part of the Ford Family Leadership Cohort number 2. And so they're doing a lot of improvements out there. In the coming weeks, you'll see a paved path. We'll be putting in a whirl-around unit. It's kind of like an aerial merry-go-round, so the kids will hang on it and spin around. You know, when we were all kids, you'd sit on it, and it would spin around, and kids would get stuck underneath, and legs would get broken. Yeah. People don't like that anymore, so now they've built it up, so you hang on it, and then you get spun around. So it'll be fun, and I think the kids will be really excited. And it's something unique. You know, Lapine doesn't have one of those. We have swings, we have slides, we have, you know, all these different things, but this will be something unique that people will hopefully come to that park just to do. So.
Why are the swing seats so high? And all I see in there is high school students.
That's a good question. So the swing seats, that's the height, you know, by the playground regulations, is that that's the lowest that we can get. And I've seen, you know, moms and kids, you know, with babies in the baby swings, swinging them out there, and I know other people have seen that. I don't know why, you know, it's high school students that you see, but I know I've seen a variety of different students out there, but I think that's a, you know.
What do you mean it's the lowest you can go by park regulation?
So what we have is, we bought, you know, the 8-foot, kind of the 8-foot tall archway, and then they count the chain links, or they're designed at a certain length per National Playground Safety Standards or Consumer Safety. There's a Consumer Safety Product Board, and then the ASTM, which is, I think, Association of, they're kind of an oversight group to make sure quality and protection is in place. So there's certain standards that we have to meet, so we can't just go out and buy, you know, a swing set from anybody. We have to buy it, you know, we have to, there are certain rules that we have to apply. So we have to have 12 inches of special chips. Those chips out there aren't just chips you go down to the chip yard and dump in there. They have to be screened through various size filters because they have to meet ADA standards. And then they have to also meet fall hazard standards. So if a kid falls and impales himself on a chip, you know, they can't come back and sue us, but because we have these appropriate chips. So it's all these standards. So if we wanted to lower the chains, then it would be outside of that standard because there isn't the standard length is what we have, and it's the longest standard length that we can get. To go to another standard, the playground manufacturer would have to go through another approval process, and that would take time and obviously effort and money on their and our part probably to make that happen. So, I mean, the other alternative we can do is just pile more chips there. You know, and I think that's something that we can definitely do. And when we get the whirl around, I'm pretty confident that we'll have some leftover chips and we can just put it under the swing set to raise that level. Yeah. And I think that's the other way we can address it. Yeah. So.
I just think about my own grandkids.
Yeah.
And it's just too high for my grandkids.
Yeah.
You know, and they're big enough to be out by themselves while I'm over doing something else, but they've got to really work hard to get up into that seat. So that's my focus.
Yeah.
And where I come from on that.
So. I think that's good feedback. You know, I think it's good to know what height, and you know, I think the easiest way to adjust it is just to put more chips underneath there. And one, it'll be safer, and two, it'll help the kids like you're talking about. So.
Yeah. Anybody else?
Listening to that, I wonder how I managed to get this old.
me too.
We didn't have all of that stuff, right?
I know it's ridiculous, and I think it's frustrating because there's a lot of good people, and a lot of people want to do a lot of good things, but there's just these hoops that we have to jump through, the costly hoops at that. I mean, we can get chips donated. I mean, we live in Lapine. I mean, there's pine chips everywhere. I mean, it's really not that hard, but to have to pay, you know, $1,000 to have certified playground chips is kind of ridiculous. But unfortunately, there's people out there that see these as opportunities to, you know, to make a quick buck. And and I think times are tough right now, and so we gotta be careful.
Yeah. I'd let the public now say who you are and ask your question.
Who
are you?
Not the playground.
For the record.
No names. Anyway, the Finley Butte, the baseball field.
Uh-huh.
All I've seen is you're watering the backside, and none of the two front fields aren't being watered. Is there a reason for that? And then I have another question, so you can answer that. What about Little League? I know that, you know, Kim and I used to do volunteer for Little League, and I haven't seen any Little League games there or Little League, programs or anything in a long time.
Yeah, so the first question, why are we watering only that one field, kind of that green one that I showed earlier, right? So there was irrigation on those two fields, the southern two fields, but it wasn't adequate to keep the grass green. You may recall a couple years ago there was a volunteer effort. They went out, they installed an irrigation system, but it wasn't up to snuff. I mean, it was a small pump, not enough water, not enough pressure, too small a pipe. It wasn't designed to a standard that's required by Rainbird, which is the company that makes all the irrigation systems. So unfortunately, what was put into the ground just didn't cut it. So we had to, and we only had money to do one side. So we were able to do that one corner. And our hope is that this next year, with our success of applying for grants, our hope is to apply for another grant to match it with some volunteer resources to purchase the material, then to use volunteer labor to go out there and to build the additional irrigation for those other two fields to the park district standard, which would then provide adequate irrigation. And so that's one thing that we thought about when we specified the pump, was making sure the pump was big enough and the controller was big enough to be able to hit all three fields eventually. So it's our goal. We didn't have the resources. We only had the resources to do that field. And we chose that field because we can play the most. We can play soccer, we can play adult softball, and we can play Little League on that field. So we got the most bang for our buck with that field. The other two fields, they have too short of fence distances in order to accommodate both youth and adult use. So in order to get the most bang for our buck, we chose that field. So, but we'll be irrigating the other two, hopefully, you know, this next spring, you know, summertime, and getting some grass out there as well. So, and then the Little League is still around. They have about over 175 kids, I think, that participate in Little League. They do both girls softball and boys baseball and t-ball and all the different programs. Right now the park district's working with them to continue to encourage them to move forward. They've been struggling to get volunteers to serve on their board and to, you know, do some of the day-to-day operations of recruiting coaches and that type of thing. So the park district's trying to come alongside of them and help them out, you know, encourage them and work together to make sure and ensure that Little League happens every year in La Pine. So, yeah.
Is it what? Where do they play?
They play out there. Yeah, they play on the Little League field. With the fence, and then they use the other field this year. They just kind of scrape the weeds off and play it on. They practiced on it, mm-hmm. But this year they'll be able to use two fields out there. So. Yeah, they're usually out there after March and then until about June is kind of their time frames.
Anybody else? Okay.
So next is draft park rules, and I'll be referring mainly to the presentation. I'm sure all of you have had some time to read this. Is that correct? And so I'm sure you have some questions. And you know, I want to get through kind of the high points, talk about the process, and then we can review this document. And if you have any specific questions or specific comments, I want to make sure I capture those for when I report back to the Parks Board. So a little bit about the process is. And I probably should have added the public involvement piece on here, is I met with the Chamber Board back at their meeting on October 11th, sent out the draft rules, you know, made an announcement at the Chamber breakfast, you know, the draft rules are out here, you know, go look online. Also here at the board, they didn't have any feedback for me at that time. The Chamber Board, next I'm meeting with you guys to talk about the draft rules, and then on November 3rd we're holding a public open house, which has been advertised in Newbury Eagle, Frontiers, Wise Buys on our website. So the draft rules are out there. So the next step, and I've also contacted Frontier Days to get on their agenda, but they haven't told me that they have another meeting coming up, so I don't know if I'm going to be able to get in touch with the Frontier Days board, but I'd like to present to their board and talk about the draft park rules, because I think it's important to make sure that we touch all of the major stakeholders, kind of the big ones that use all of our parks, just to make sure, you know, we're all on the same page, you know, we all have an understanding of what's being put out there, what we're talking about, how, you know, how will these be enforced, how will this all happen. So then I'll share that public comment with the board on November 8th. December 14th, we'll take kind of the public comment, you know, any changes the board may have, put it into the final draft, hold the public hearing on December 14th, and, you know, it's tentative. If we need to refine it anymore, then it'll be moved out to January 10th, and then hold a second public hearing and approve on January 10th, and then they're 30 days later, they're effective. So that's February 10th that the park rules will then go into effect. Some of the draft rules, some of the key things are, as it addresses alcohol in our parks. One thing we've had some problems with is alcohol being consumed as part of our adult softball league. And so this will now give us the authority to you know, take care of the adult alcohol, or at least have a mechanism to enforce that at our parks and on our playgrounds. We still are going to allow alcohol by permit. So if you have a special event, you know, like Frontier Days, we have an alcohol permit, which we've had as part of our facility reservation packet. So there is a process, you know, to make sure to have alcohol if you want to have alcohol. There's just a little bit more insurance requirement, and the insurance requirement isn't in this document because this is more broad, and then the facility policies are more a little bit more focused on facilities. So alcohol is being addressed. Dogs, you know, we talk about dogs being on leash, except for in designated off-leash areas. You know, off-leash areas are a big thing right now. You know, people want to be able to exercise their dog, throw a frisbee for their dog. You know, one thing we may even consider is off-leash hours, you know, from the hours of 2 to 4. XYZ Park is off, this area is off leash. That way, there is an opportunity to use that, but we don't have to have a dedicated fenced off space for that off leash area. So, that might be something that we do, but that is more a function of the rules, not necessarily needs to be a rule, because you'll see it here that it delegates the authority to the director of Parks and Rec to be able to designate areas for dogs. So, and then also no livestock. You know, we don't want necessarily all the horse problems that come with that, but we could definitely, but not limited, are permitted on district property, except as authorized. So if we have a horse event that wants to come to Roslyn, or a horse event that wants to come to a certain park, you know, we can provide that we can designate that area for that event. So we want to be able to limit just general use of, you know, horses and livestock, but specifically, you know, if there's an event that we've talked to with the people about, we can permit that. Tobacco products, you know, we talk about smoking in here. One thing I heard from several people is just smoking in our parks, you know, at special events. And so we have this in here. One compromise, and what we did in developing these rules is I previewed them with the board, and they liked kind of how they were as written. One change they did make was to Article 1, Number 1, the Director of Parks and Rec, with approval from the board. That's one change that they made, with approval from the board, is authorized to establish rules and regulations. So the board likes kind of how these rules were presented, but I think one thing that one opportunity, and they're fairly strict, you know, so there's kind of one swing, you know, and I think somewhere in the middle is the happy medium. One thing about tobacco is there was another park, in looking at the rules, try and create the rules, they said that you could smoke in the parking lot. So that was kind of a compromise that was struck, I think, within their community. So that may be something that the district consider. Then we have open and close. You know, we don't have any open and close hours. And the one thing that helps us do is allows peace officers or cops to be able to approach people in our parks after hours and, you know, say, hey, what are you doing here? Or, why are you here? And that's from 10 to 5. It's Article 6. But if they're, you know, we got to think long term. So let's say we have a trail. You know, we built a trail or built a path, or a person just simply walking through a park. They aren't doing anything. So we do allow for a pedestrian may travel through district property to destinations outside of the district property. So we recognize that people are going to be walking on district property, but they just need to keep walking. So the penalty for this is exclusion, and in talking with the Deschutes County Sheriff, that's typically how they handle this, and they'll be the ones to enforce this. In talking with the lieutenant up there, what they typically do is they'll approach somebody, hey, you know, you're in violation of blah, this XYZ rule, you know, please comply. If you don't, then I'm going to trespass you. You know, we're going to ask you, we're going to exclude you from this park. So this gives the officers kind of the authority that they already have, the practice that they're already practicing. And like most rules and regulations, our goal is not to, you know, not to beat people over the head with these or force compliance, but to simply remind people of the rules. And if there is an egregious violation, then we have the teeth in order to be able to address that. So it's not, you know, our goal is not to be punitive. Our goal is to work with the community to seek compliance. So kind of the questions that I have for you is kind of to stimulate some feedback. Are there any areas of concern that are not addressed in the rules as proposed? So is there anything that you can think of in your head that may happen in our parks that you don't see in these rules that we should be addressing? And then the second part is any rules that you'd like to see the board consider amending or revising or softening, if you will.
Do you see as a problem, and I'm not sure if your rules address it, but just, you know, kids hanging out on the stage and stuff like that. Is that really a problem or not? And do your rules have anything to say about that?
You know, it's a park. The idea of a park is for people to be able to loiter in a park, you know, be able to hang out, you know, enjoy the sun, enjoy, you know, the activities. However, if they're being disruptive, let's say they're playing music too loud, they're drinking, they're smoking, you know, they're carrying on in an unusual way, you know, then that's something that we don't want to tolerate, you know. I think in here we have something about allowing people to, yeah, no person shall disturb, injure, or endanger the comfort, health, peace, or safety of others on district property. Article 1, Number 3. So I think, you know, that's fairly loose, but mm-hmm. it's if people are disturbing, you know, other individuals, then that's something that we can address mm-hmm. with this item here.
So is this modeled after other park districts?
Yes. Yeah. We looked at Corvallis, we looked at Sisters, we looked at Redmond, we looked at Cook County, we looked at Bend, we looked at Corvallis, I think, did I say that? Medford, yeah. So we kind of looked all over, and those are kind of the agencies that people definitely look to, like Medford, Corvallis, and Bend. They're kind of cutting edge, you know, they do a lot of great things. So we definitely looked at what they use, and then we also looked at smaller communities of comparable size and how did they address these rules. And Sisters, they don't even have park rules at this point. So they're kind of in the same boat we are, just starting up and getting the ball rolling. So this was something that came to our attention after last year. If you remember, there's a situation with a dog at the Lapine Event Center in the grass area there. A dog attacked. Two pit bulls attacked the show dog that was training, and it really upset a mother, and she came to the city council, came to the park district. So this is kind of hoping to address some of her concerns as well as other just general concerns with the parks. You know, we have people that are drinking in the park, and people that are smoking in the park, and it's disturbing other people that are trying to enjoy the park. So now we have an ability to be able to ask that individual, hey, you know, we have a park rule that says, you know, smoking, would you mind, or smoking in the parking lot, would you mind going to XYZ area to do your behavior? So. And I think people, for the most part, know what general park rules are. I think this just allows us to have that enforcement opportunity.
So a couple of points of coordination.
Okay.
I guess I should ask to be recognized, but a couple of points of coordination is that...
can you reference the page?
Yeah, it's Article 1, Number 4, Number L.
Uh-huh.
So we have a mass gathering ordinance that has some language about sound. So did you coordinate with our ordinances and kind of so that they don't contradict one another, or they...
Well, I know that there was... I didn't know that the mass gathering passed. I knew that there was conversations, did it, so yeah. It's passed mm-hmm. and everything like that.
And it does speak
about... And I can look into that, so...
And then we just passed the leash law. Or not the leash law, but the dog ordinance.
Right.
So...
That's for the whole... You know, and eventually we'll have parks outside of the city. Mm-hmm. And so our goal is to make sure that all of our parks are in compliance, not just the ones within the city. But I think it's also important to be able to meet, you know, the needs of the citizens in our parks, you know, with off-leash areas. And I don't think the rule would allow... And looking at your dog rules, it doesn't mm-hmm. allow for off-leash areas. And I think that was one thing that we wanted to be able to make sure that we could provide was an off-leash area.
Oh, so then our ordinance explicitly...
Well, it doesn't address the issue of off-leash or the designation of off-leash areas. I think it says something about verbal command, but it doesn't really necessarily designate off-leash areas or the opportunity to designate off-leash areas. And that's one thing, I looked at the off-leash law prior to conceiving these rules.
And should I continue?
Sure, you would.
Okay. What was another thing? So, and number 10, the sexually explicit material as defined by Oregon law.
Uh-huh.
Doesn't that kind of go over what the federal obscenity laws are? Seems like it's just so explicit. Is that from another park district? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's just art shows or, you know, it's not that... It's not that we want to, it's kind of curtailing, you know, that issue of sexually explicit material. So let's say you have an art show and somebody may see something that's sexually explicit to them, you know, we can simply ask them to, hey, you know, don't have it be your first painting that people look at, maybe put it in the back corner, you know, and that's...
It's all just so subjective.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're saying
that... It's as by the Oregon law, so whatever Oregon law is, that's what we would enforce.
But now that paragraph come out of somebody else's?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's been vetted, you know, on several different occasions. And like I told Ken, you know, all the rules that we've looked at have been approved by various city attorneys. And we didn't change any of the wording. We either, you know, cut and pasted that rule, or, you know, that's literally what we did, is cut or paste it, or look for kind of the rules that we liked. And so we put together this document of different rules that have been approved and vetted by city attorneys, by district attorneys, by, you know, their insurance carriers. And so now we have our council looking at it in order to make sure that it complies with their rules and regulations, if you will, as well. So.
Are you done, or can I just inject something? I kind of look at something as profound as this, like we did our charter. You know, we put a committee together, and it had its chair, and we had the city manager, and I'm just going to say what we did, go out and pull these rules together, and that committee spent the time looking over what this town had, what that town, and was this done the same way? Or who actually put all this together?
Staff did. I did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then presented it to our board. And then the board reviewed it, and they said, hey, looks great. Let's do a public process. So we're meeting with stakeholders, you know, the city. We talked with the sheriff. We talked with, you know, the Chamber of Commerce. We hope to talk with Frontier Days, you know, the public at our November 3rd public meeting. And then there's several other, then there's the November 8th meeting, then there's the December 10th meeting, the December 14th meeting, the January 10th meeting, that people can come and give their input. So.
So,
it wasn't done by committee.
Yeah, okay. I just go back to the smoking thing.
Article 1, number 13.
Yeah. So, the way this reads, there's no smoking on park property.
Correct.
Okay. What about Roslyn and the campsites? I mean, you got people sitting around drinking a beer and wanting to smoke, and I mean, okay.
That's it. Yeah. I'll put that as a point of feedback. Yeah. Like Roslyn. Yeah.
Another one. I saw
the alcohol. I think we allowed it at Roslyn too.
And what was the determination about or the situations around adults playing softball and alcohol?
Basically drinking and playing softball, and that's a liability issue. You know, somebody with a blood alcohol level above them, you know, of any level, swinging an aluminum bat or a wood bat with another individual standing behind them trying to catch a ball, just, it's not good practice, and it's not allowed in other leagues, but, you know, our league has just had trouble accepting that. So,
does that mean there's no alcohol can be drank during softball tournaments?
Yeah.
By just the players or anybody?
If anybody, it would be anybody, period, at this point, unless they apply. Let's say the softball tournament wanted to have, they apply for a permit, you know, then they could have alcohol, they could serve alcohol. So. Mm-hmm. But there would be a process, and then they'd have to have liability insurance, you know, alcohol.
But is it described in here? Because it doesn't appear to be described in here that way.
It talks about alcohol being allowed with permit. No person shall drink or be in possession of an open container. Article 1, number 6,
right.
Page 2. Except in designated campsite, so it does address, you know, the campsite. Maybe that's what type of language we'll use with the smoking. Without obtaining an alcohol permit issued by the district. So if somebody wanted to have, you know, Frontier Days, they have alcohol, they would get an alcohol permit. And all it is just, it's a piece of paper that says, you know, I understand that I need to have insurance, that I need to have this, and they sign their name. And then it allows them to have alcohol. It's nothing erroneous or, you know, it's just, we want to know that people are drinking in our parks. We want to know that we're covered if somebody was to swing a bat and get clocked in the head and that person was inebriated.
Well, but you've been very specific here, except in a designated campsite. You know, that doesn't speak to a baseball field where you've got adults playing baseball and
right.
the fans are sitting out there with their coolers, you know.
But I guess what I'm saying is that if people want to do that, they can come and get a permit, and then we can designate that area for the event. Well, they'll be able to serve alcohol. So it's allowable. It's just, it's not, it doesn't need to be explicit, I think is what I'm saying. I think the reason we call out the campsite is because we manage a campground and it's kind of a specific issue. Like the smoking thing, you know, does it smoking allowed in a designated camp in a campsite, you know, would be a good way to handle that. But to say, you know, that's why we have drinking alcohol is without obtaining an alcohol permit issued by the district.
You know, let me give you an example.
Uh-huh.
I'm pulling into town. Uh-huh. I decide to pull into Roslyn and spend the night. So I get in there and I get myself set up and everything. And I'm going to pop myself a beer because it's a hot day.
Yeah.
Where's my permit? Where do I know that? I mean, I'm just a guy from Medford, let's say, and I pull in there and I open up a can and or a bottle and you know.
The language doesn't require permit in an except designated campsite. It, the way it reads.
Yeah.
It says except in a designated.
Ah. Okay.
Can I add something?
Sure.
So you have the authority to... No, it's just general.
Okay.
It's about the alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the authority to issue permits for alcohol use?
Well, I mean, it's just simply a piece of paper saying, you know, we permit, you can use alcohol per our rules, but... If somebody wants to, but OLCC then has another layer, you know, for temporary service and all that.
Right.
So all we're issuing is a permit to consume alcohol on our property. We aren't issuing an OLCC permit.
Right.
All we're doing is giving
right.
permission for
I
people
think
to consume
should,
alcohol.
You should state that.
Right, but that's not, again, this is overarching. Our facility
right.
rules are very specific. Our facility rules address, you know,
so
what are the requirements of the alcohol permit? Or what are the requirements of if you're drinking alcohol?
Right, but you've
so
also...
So that's kind of in addition to this document here.
I thought you wanted to be there.
Oh, no, I do. And I'm telling you where that rule is.
Right.
You know, I'm telling you that this doesn't address it because it's addressed in other places. So.
Oh, so it's addressed in other places here that they have to go to OLCC?
No, so this document here...
They're presuming that they know.
I'm not presuming that they know. What I'm saying is that this document here is the forest. The
right.
particular tree you're talking about is the facility reservation application. So if I'm coming in to get an alcohol permit, I'm going to be handed an 8-page document. And if I can get internet access, I can show you that document. And I can show you where it specifically talks about, you know, the park rules associated with, you know, reserving the policies and procedures that we have in place for reserving a facility and what you're required to do. I mean, we can go to that fairly quickly. So.
I guess I'm on the same page with Adele. I think there should be some specifics in here, especially around alcohol.
Justin, when someone, a little league or an adult ball team comes to town, they come to you to apply for the permit to rent the field. And they'll say, we want to have beer. You say, okay, to rent this place, that is in a rental agreement.
Exactly.
Okay.
This is the rules, this is the application of the rules. And I'm pulling it up here and I can show you specifically where it's addressed. And this was approved by the board a year ago, August. So this is our facility rental application. Alcohol, right here. If you'll be providing alcohol, proof of host liquor is required. Certificate certificate of liability insurance, no bring your own alcohol, events may be scheduled, selling alcohol requires an OLCC temporary sales, and host liquor liability certificate. Copy of insurance certificate must be submitted 30 days prior to the event. The phone number for OLCC is 541-388-6219. So the rule is no alcohol. If you want to get a permit, these are the steps that you have to go through. So this is
basically what you're saying is there's no alcohol without permission.
Exactly.
And you've got to follow the law to get permission.
Correct.
Which is the way you should be doing it.
Correct. And see, in here, you know, then we have a checklist, you know, did you provide proof of liability insurance, proof of host liquor liability, OLCC temporary sales. You know, we have kind of this check here to make sure that we're, you know, making sure that people are doing what they say they're going to do. So, you know, here we ask for, does your event involve the use of alcohol, you know, provide the name, the caterer, the liquor license number, you know, and again, we iterate, you know, the need for that item.
You have to have that to cover yourself for liability. No question about it.
Again, here's kind of the alcohol information again. and this is the alcohol permit, essentially. You know, I understand that I've read the agree. I agree to abide by all rules, regulations, and guidelines specified herein. So
my suggestion still stands is that I did mention of OL, the requirements of OL, like you did in the other document, I think this is as required by state law or whatever. Is that the way that I read it is that if I if you issue a permit, then we're good. And I wouldn't know anything by reading this rule about the other requirements of OLCC. And I know that like when I had planned like I think it was a reception at a park. And I didn't know that I had to go get an OLCC license, but so it was too late because it wasn't mentioned anywhere. Mm-hmm. And that's what prompted me with that comment.
Yeah. Well, I think again, you know, this is a rule. The rule and the policy is for situations that get out of hand. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not going to be driving. I don't have time to drive to all the parks. Nor does the police officer have time to drive to all the parks. Somebody gets out of hand, there's alcohol involved, we now have the authority to say, look, there's no alcohol in the park. The person refuses to leave the park with their alcohol, the officer then has the opportunity to trespass them, exclude them from the park. It's in those situations that the rules will be applied and the rules will be followed. You know, you taking beer down to the park, having a good time, you know, nothing bad happens, I don't know about it. It's like everybody driving down the freeway at 75 miles an hour. Everybody drives down the freeway or highway at 70 miles an hour. The only time they're breaking the law, but the only time you're breaking the law is when a cop pulls you over. And I think that's the idea here. It's not to be heavy-handed about it. It's not to, you know, be authoritarian. It's not to go out there and shake people down for smoking, for, you know, doing alcohol. It's if it gets out of hand. And if it's endangering or injuring somebody, then we have the authority to go out and address it. So, because I'm not going to be out there 24/7 patrolling our parks, nor are the cops. So.
I just think that this could be explained a little better in this document, because this is the rules and regulations, where you've got another document sitting over here on the side that somebody may never see.
Yeah, and maybe what we can do is refer to... Yeah.
I mean, you've used in several cases here Oregon state law, you know, and I just think when it gets down to an area that, I mean, I read this and I said, well, gee whiz, all I got to do is get a liquor alcohol permit issued by the district, you know, and then I go off and plan things, and then all of a sudden I go down and talk to Park and Rec. No, you got to get an OLCC permit. So I think in several places where I've read through this, I think it could be explained better. And that was really why my email today to ask you if this had been vetted by the by your attorney. And I mean, I would have thought that before we started going through a process, we, you know, it would have been a good idea, because if you go through all this process in the very end, and I don't know where it is with the attorney, but you get the attorney comes along and says, hey, wait a minute, there's some issues here, and you've already gone to the chamber, you've gone to the city council, and you've gone to other places, and so that feedback, it just, to me, it's sort of the cart before the horse. But
Justin, I think it's very good, and you know, I think the city also has places where we refer to Oregon state law, and I see it as no different than some of the policies that the city has, mm-hmm. and I'm behind this 100%. If I had my way, there wouldn't be any alcohol in any of the parks, because you look at a lot of your college games, your college parks, there's none allowed whatsoever. You have to go through a gate to go through the parks, and they search your backpacks. So I'm surprised that some of the council is objecting to this.
No,
I'm totally in favor of it.
I think you misunderstood. I wasn't objecting to the alcohol rules. I was objecting to no reference to OLCC.
And that was my point. The other piece is feedback.
Mr. Mayor, I think if you're handed this, you're probably handed the other document at the same time, aren't you?
Well, what's going to happen is we'll likely post, not this whole packet, but we'll post the important rules, dogs on leash, no alcohol in the park, no smoking,
firearms.
Firearms, all that stuff. We'll post that on your typical park sign that you see, has rules, please, refrain from blah, blah, blah while you're visiting our lovely park. And it'll have the rules and, it'll reference the ORS, it'll reference, the park district adopting these, and then that's what the officer will use in order to cite the individual, as well as their trespassing ordinance that the county has, and what they use currently in order to deal with people in our parks. So,
Justin,
uh-huh.
On this number 6 on the second page about drinking alcohol, and it says obtaining an alcohol permit issued by the district. I think you said something a while back, or I read in here, that they had to post it 30 days in advance. Why can't that just be added there? That must be approved within 30 days in advance of the activity.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that cover it? And then when they ask about the 30 days, you can explain the other things that they have to do. Does that make sense or not?
Makes sense to me.
Personally, I like the rules and regulations too. I think they're well thought out. It appears to me that there's been a lot of work done on it. And I'm sure it's just like any other document that you write. It's not set in concrete, that as time goes by and it's that you see there's need for change, and the public has that same attitude that there should be change, that the rules can be changed accordingly. Mm-hmm. But for something to start out with, I think it's an excellent document, my personal opinion.
Can I point out a couple things?
Yeah, that'd be great.
This is really minor. On the first page, number 4B, that I think you meant to use accept instead of expect in that first line. No person shall require mm-hmm. accept. That's just a good note.
No person shall build a fire accept.
I didn't hear what you said.
That's expect.
Oh, expect, yeah.
It's just
thank
a word.
Yeah.
The wrong word.
Wrong.
Okay.
Thank you.
And then I was wondering about on the next page, in number 5, the second page, where it talks about glass containers are not allowed on the district property. That seems pretty exclusive. It seems like there maybe should be some exceptions. I can imagine in a kitchen or at a banquet or a glass beer bottle or something that maybe there would be certain don't know. It seems like there ought to be certain times when that ought to be accepted.
Well, when you've got a canning, you know, like the Frontier Days, they've got a canning
show. In the
show, and, you know, it doesn't have to be necessarily be Frontier Days, but it can be anybody that's doing things.
Think so your point of feedback would be that you'd like to see this reconsidered, or is that
well, or maybe glass containers
except by permit only.
Yeah.
I can understand why that's in there. Just
it's probably a safety thing, but it just seems like there's a lot of glass containers.
Well, what about a mixing bowl in one of the kitchens?
If somebody breaks a bottle on the property and some kid comes along and cuts a tendon in their foot and there's a severe operation, the park district's liable for that. So I think a reasonable thing.
Well, in my view, is somebody's taken a box full of glass jars, you know, that's got food canned in them, you know. Right. These are very responsible people. They're going to handle it properly. And this says no glass jars on the property. I mean, granted, all of that about what you just said about liability and all that, that's a given. But this says are not allowed on district property. So
there might be a way to just...
I mean, you've got to reword that. That's in a fashion that would cover alternative situations. Mm-hmm.
The other one that I really dislike government when it's not necessary and regulations when they're not necessary. And so I look at this number 12 and talked about that you can't jump, dive, or launch off of a district-owned bridge, and I can't think of a district-owned bridge.
Well, I wrote that down here. What bridge does the district own?
Future. Future bridges.
Okay, well then let's put it in when we have one. Because it's like... We already have laws on bridges that go nowhere, you know, or don't exist.
And I can take that back.
Okay. One more then. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, just the only other one that I think it just, you know, when you look at this from so many perspectives, you pick up what ifs, you know. On page 4, item 5, where it talks about dogs in designated off-leash dog areas. Mm-hmm. It's a good rule, this one about the owner or keeper of the dog shall be found in violation of this rule if the dog is not wearing its collar or tag. There could be and that's talking about Deschutes County, it's very possible that you'd have a visitor or a tourist come through and they're walking their dog in this park and they're not even a Deschutes County resident or something, and I that's one of those things where you're not out patrolling and probably never get picked up, but it just seems like it's a little, there may be a way to
word it
so it's not, doesn't put that person in jeopardy of getting a ticket or something. You know, I don't know. And then the only other thing, and I'm just throwing this out because I don't know that it affects us at the city level, but just as a citizen, the language in a lot of this, in most places it says that the director of the parks recreation or designee does things, you know. But then on page 6 and number 3 it says the district at the very top. On page 6, it says a district will provide written notice, and then it talks about the appeal, and it just seems like to me that there ought to be an appeal process that appeals to somebody other than the one that's the enforcer or the person that puts the rules together. There ought to be, I guess it seems to me that maybe the board or a committee on the board or somebody ought to be the appeal
process.
Person rather than having to appeal back to you, who's actually the one that's administering the rules.
Yeah, I mean, so the district provides the written notice. It's not a function, I think it's...
Well, number 4 all talks about the director and being appealed to the director and all that.
I wrote a note here beside that. Where's the board's authority to review this?
I mean, to review which part?
This whole thing about what we're talking about here. Because
I was thinking about, you know, the average person who gets into that thing.
Yeah, we can look at that.
Because I don't think anything we do in the city can't be appealed to the city council.
Yeah.
And it would seem that anything that happens in the park district could be appealed to the park district board. Mm-hmm. And it should say that somewhere in here.
Yeah. And in those kind of situations, usually there's ways to come to understandings if you have good processes like that, rather than going to court or something else.
Yeah, so maybe under number four, it shall be conducted by the director, change that to conducted by the board. And the board or deputy will render the decision final 15 days after the hearing. So
yeah, something like that.
That might be a location. But we can check with that legal.
Yeah, kind of see what.
Well, but I think in number five, Dan, at any time during the exclusion, an excluded person may petition in writing to the director of Park and Recreation or designee for a temporary waiver of the exclusion. There would also be a place in there that the exclusion as described in 3 and 4, any excluded person may petition the board in writing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just change it from director to board.
Yeah.
No, that's a good feedback.
I think it is good. I think it's a good thing, though, because it helps have an understanding up front for people. Mm-hmm. And not find out later, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, we shouldn't have done it. Mm-hmm. So, and then the idea of having a sign in each park or something that kind of have, yeah. Like you mentioned that, but like when you go to I see it all the time if you go to the coast, you know, and there's a sign when you walk on the beach that says what you can or can't do.
No glass container.
No glass container, yeah.
Watch out for broken glass.
Just one more for me, just on the second page, or third page, I'm sorry, down at the bottom on item 5. Dog owners must control their animals at all times. It is unlawful for an owner or keeper to allow a dog or animal to. Unlawful to who? And you see where I'm at?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Unlawful to who? So then if you keep on going down, for an owner or keeper to allow a dog or animal to, allow a dog or animal to engage, allow a dog or animal to harass. I mean, I'm not the greatest
spell check
linguist in the world, but that is so redundant and unnecessary to jump right out at you.
Yeah, I mean, I'll check with our legal counsel. I mean, it may be something that's required by the lawyers. You know, they never really make sense sometimes. So. But I'll double check that. Especially the two, who is it unlawful to, and then is there a need for that repetition? Yeah.
Just one more.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
On page 4, Article 4, Vehicles, item number 2, no vehicle shall be parked in a loading zone or district property for more than 30 minutes. What about a truck that's in loading and it's going to take them an hour?
Well, I think that gets back to the reasonableness of Yeah, somebody's there and they're taking their sweet time, and we need something to be able to prod them along with, and this gives us the authority to prod them along.
You know, this is a small
town. It's kind of like parking in a loading zone. How long do you get to park in a loading zone?
Well,
or the white curb is for loading and unloading of passengers only.
I just think that.
What's your concern? Would you like to see it revised?
Well, I think you revise it to a phrase that that stipulates, you can't park in a loading or unloading zone unless you're loading or unloading, I'm not sure that having a time there it really binds you up to a point. So I guess I'm saying that you could have that, but. Just have it that.
Because you could be unloading for 60 minutes. Why put a time on it?
Yeah, why put a time on it? So. Okay.
So while they're unloading, they could be drinking a beer in a glass container with the dog off leash. They could be in trouble. And smoking too.
Counsel?
I think it's part of the maturing process of our Parks and Rec district, and I think it's coming together real nicely.
I do too. I absolutely no problem. I think that the parks need rules, and once it's out there, people learn what they are. They better understand how they ought to act. So I think it's a good move forward.
The other thing to keep in mind is that most people aren't breaking these rules right now. I mean, for the most part, people are using our parks appropriately. Yeah. We have problems with kids out at Finley View, moving picnic tables and turning them upside down and climbing on the roof. But, those are kid things. And,
if that's all they're doing, you're lucky.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we need, where that bridge was, maybe we need to have them jump. She can't be jumping off the buildings.
It's covered in there.
Never mind.
Damage to face of district property.
Yeah.
Anything else for us, Justin? Or?
No, that's it. Thank you for your time and thank you for your feedback. And I'll be taking this to the board on November 8th. And I think it's kind of that two-step legal process, because obviously there are some legal questions we had tonight that if we make changes, then we'll need to go back to our legal counsel and make sure that it's appropriate. So that's kind of the balance there is, what we have here. We feel confident based on other park districts' experience and other cities' experience. Mm-hmm. What we have here is defensible, but we're still checking with our council. But, the other important thing is once we make these tweaks, then going back and making sure that, again, it's defensible and it complies with the Oregon Revised Statute. So.
The nature of the process.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And that's why I put a lot of the dates as being tentative, is it may take more time,
Good start.
Yeah, thank you guys.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay.
What do you have in there if we get an organization that's going to take over La Pine and just moves in? How are we going to handle them?
What?
Like Mies Rush.
Just like they are in the other cities around. They take over the park and do whatever they want to do.
Oh, yeah.
Well, but if it's in the city, you have your mass gathering ordinance.
Right.
Doesn't do any good. They sit there anyway.
You enforce it. They're not enforcing it.
Yeah. Okay. Again, thank you, Justin.
Yeah.
Other matters?
No.
And public comments?
No. I do have a question.
Mayor Kitty?
I'm sorry. Yes, Kitty Shields, 51540 Shields Drive. On Article 1, Number 7, and this may already be covered, is it now standard procedure for public places to have more toilets and female restrooms than they have in male restrooms? Because there have been many, many times where I have had to use the restroom designated for the other sex because the line is way too long.
Yeah.
So that's already...
Well, we'll have, yeah, I mean, for number 7, I mean, we try to find that balance of what's required by code for how many people we're going to have in the building and going overboard with restrooms. And so, take for instance, the Lapine Event Center, we'll have 4 holes for the females and 4 holes, or 2 holes and 2 urinals for the males. And then there'll be a family restroom that is any gender. So that'll essentially be 5 toilets per restroom, per gender.
Okay, per gender, and yeah. Then you have the family one in addition?
No, that includes the family
one. If you have 5 per gender, that's not going to work.
Well, that's finding that balance between normal use and peak use. We aren't going to build a bathroom that has 30 toilets.
No, I understand, and I'm not getting at that. What I'm saying is, in any public, where there are public events going on, you always need more toilets for the females than you do for the females. It just takes us longer to do the same thing. The lines get longer. So, and that is taken into consideration with...
Yeah, I mean, we have 4 restrooms, and it was taken into consideration of what the code requires and what, you know, what's best practice.
I'll trust them.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to say there's not going to be lines. I mean, there will be lines. So.
No, I understand that there are those times where there will be.
Yeah. Oh, and that's in the event center?
Yeah.
What's the capacity of your event center?
I think 600 people.
I can see the line now.
Yeah. I mean, well, but that's peak use. I mean, that's normal use. There isn't going to be 600 people in there every day.
What I'm kind of getting at is peak use. If there's a line at the women's restroom, you would figure there's also going to be a line at the men's restroom because you would figure there's enough to accommodate all of them.
Now they're out urinating where they're not supposed to.
Oh, we got a rule against that.
That's
you know?
Right.
Not
supposed to be.
I'm sure that if Justin knows he's going to have 600 people there, he might even have some portables sitting outside to take care of the overflow.
Okay, Mr. Mayor.
I just wanted to say one more thing. I'm sorry I didn't see this earlier, but it said something about no cell phones
no
cameras and all that. No, I won't even go there. I'm thinking about it. Somebody in the bathroom and their cell phone rings. You think they're not going to answer it? Okay, so we're moving right along here. And other matters? Council?
Doug has it.
I had a question, Mr. Mayor. Douglas Ward, 52657 Pine Drive in the city of Lubbock. And I'm speaking on behalf of the Planning Commission. Last week we made a recommendation to fill the 2 empty seats with 2 very qualified candidates, one who lives in the city, one who lives outside, which meets the criteria. And we were simply asked that the sooner you could take it up and have a determination, the better it would be for us, especially with our next meeting being the first meeting in the new City Hall. If we could...
When is that, your next meeting?
16th of November. If we could have a full body, it would just be to our advantage.
I'm sure that the city manager will have that on the list for the meeting of the City Council in the new City Council chambers on the 9th of November.
Very good. Thank you very much.
And it is right now.
It is.
It is good. Thank you.
According to the administrative staff report, thank you. It is. Thank you, Patty. Mm-hmm. Are there any other public comments? I hear a motion to adjourn.
I make that motion.
I second.
Any questions? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
We're adjourned.
Cool.